From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, challenges of defending democracy around the world. Our guest, Damon Wilson, president of the National Endowment for Democracy. That's a private nonprofit foundation dedicated to the growth and strengthening of democratic institutions around the world. Founded in 1983, NED is a non-governmental institution, but receives the bulk of its funding from Congress. According to its website, NED is on the leading edge of democratic struggles everywhere and has evolved into a multifaceted institution that serves as a hub for resources, intellectual exchange for activists, practitioners, and scholars of democracy throughout the globe. NED is dedicated to fostering the growth of a wide range of democratic institutions abroad, including political parties, trade unions, free markets, and business organizations, as well as the many elements of a vibrant civil society that ensure human rights, an independent media, and the rule of law. The endowment is guided by the belief that freedom is a universal human aspiration that can be realized through the development of democratic institutions, procedures, and values. It also asserts that democracy cannot be achieved through a single election and need not be based upon the model of the United States or any other particular country. It's hard to imagine a more capable person to lead an organization dedicated to promoting democracy globally than Damon Wilson. Previously, he served as special assistant to the president and senior director for European affairs at the National Security Council during the second term of President George W. Bush. In this capacity, Damon Wilson helped to deter and counter Russian aggression and work with Europe to support democracy around the world. Damon has also held numerous senior positions in the U.S. Civil Service, from serving at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad to manning the State Department's China desk to serving as deputy director in the private office of former NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson. There, Wilson played a lead role regarding the alliance's response to 9/11 and its operations in Afghanistan and the Western Balkans. In 2011, he became the executive vice president at the Atlantic Council, a prominent think tank here in Washington, where he championed American leadership, a strong NATO, and support for democratic reforms in Ukraine and the Balkans. He advocated for positioning U.S. and NATO forces in the Baltic states and efforts to counter authoritarian powers, Russia and China. And Damon Wilson joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Carol, it's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you for having me on.
Well, thank you, Damon Wilson. I think your background speaks volumes. NED is very lucky to have you at its helm. You know, I gave a cursory description of the organization, but what is your understanding, Damon, of why NED was created during the Ronald Reagan years, and why is it still relevant today?
Carol, that's a great question. The endowment is really a special place. It's a special institution. You know, it grew out of a tradition in our country, first on the left with the AFL-CIO supporting the Solidarity Movement in Poland under communism, Jimmy Carter's push for human rights and foreign policy, and then President Reagan comes to office and mounts a really strong stand against the evils of communism. And in his famous address he gave in Westminster Hall in London, he called on the need for the creation of institutions to support a global infrastructure for democracy, to stand by independent media, civil society, political party development, but also understanding business associations and labor. And that's what really led a group of citizens in the United States with members of Congress to come together to help support the launch of the National Endowment for Democracy, an extraordinary institution, a creature of Congress. It's funded by Congress, as you say, but was intentionally set up to be independent, to be a private 501c3 foundation, so that it wouldn't be a government bureaucracy, neither subject to the twists and turns of administration policy from one president to the next, exclusively focused on a mission of supporting democracy around the world, but to build it into a private foundation so that we could be nimble, flexible, take risks, and really ultimately develop a way of supporting democracy that's quite unique. It's based on relationships. It's based on trust. It's based on really knowing actors on the ground around the world doing amazingly courageous work. and figuring out how we can give them oxygen, often moral support and sometimes material support. And that's produced the endowment of today, something that started 40 years ago at a time when communism was on the march. There wasn't a real sense of a democratic opening. And yet the endowment was really riding the wave of being supporting those around the world through a huge expansion of democracy after the fall of the Iron Curtain. Flash forward to today, the challenge is back on. And that's why our work is as relevant forever. And we can talk about that, Carol.
Absolutely. I want to talk about why it's so relevant today, especially with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, a sovereign country, almost like going back to the old Soviet days. But with respect to supporting political parties, private sector, independent media, I do note also that your foundation supports, for example, IRI, the International Republican Institute, and NDI, the National Democratic Institute. One might ask, why do we need both institutions? Talk about these particular institutes, both of which we've spoken to in the past. And I just want to get a bit more of an understanding as to, yes, why they're being funded.
Absolutely, Carol. So it's really called the NED family. And we really think of it that way. It is a NED family. And in some respects, it binds together really important forces in American democracy, the two main political parties, Democrats, Republicans, but also business and labor. So we have four core institutes that are known as part of the NED family, IRI and NDI representing the two parties, but also the Solidarity Center associated with labor and the Center for National Private Enterprise associated with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And this diversity, I mean, these are groups that in American politics argue, disagree, they're part of the fabric of debate in our own democracy, but they come together as entities overseas, understanding the importance of supporting those business associations, labor groups, political party development on a nonpartisan basis, developing the expertise of parliaments, sharing knowledge across borders to really help support others in their journey to develop their political systems. And so half of our support does go to these four core institutes that have field offices around the world. And roughly the other half of our support goes directly to actors around the world in 100 countries, more than 100 countries, that are independent civic organizations or independent media outlets. And it really is this diverse group of actors that are part of the fabric of nurturing a healthy global infrastructure for democracy, whether it's political party systems, the election process, or civic engagement, inclusion of marginalized populations, independent media, and access to information. And it's this recognition that, as you said at the beginning, democracy is not one election. It's so much more complex than that. And it is for societies to figure out their own path, their own way, to work on their own struggle. But we bring these diverse tools together to help others who are seeking a pathway towards democratic change and development to provide them the backing they need to figure it out for themselves.
Damon Wilson, let's get some specific examples so that our audience understands specifically how you make your grants and to whom. Your website says that you make more than 2,000 grants to support projects of non-governmental groups abroad who are working for democratic goals, as you said, in more than 100 countries. Give us a couple of examples, if you will.
Sure. So first of all, let me just say, we do this with a really healthy dose of humility. This isn't our struggle. It's not our plan. So we have a demand-driven approach where we're open to people coming to us to say, we need support for our struggle in our country. And then we really have the honor of figuring out, okay, we have the honor of being their partners. So let me give you a few examples. When Russia invaded Ukraine, Vladimir Putin thought that he could take Kiev, was really attacking just a government, just a Ukrainian army, thought he could do this quickly. What he didn't understand is that because of the support of NED and others, since actually before the fall of the Soviet Union, since 1988, we've been supporting independent civic groups in Ukraine, independent media in Ukraine. And so many people looked at Ukraine and thought, oh, we've got a problem with corruption or this government or the military is not strong. And the truth is, despite some of those drawbacks, Ukrainian civic life had shown itself really developed, really responsible NGOs, incredible investigative journalists that held Ukrainian authorities to account, that led their own revolutions in the country, the Orange Revolution, the Revolution for Dignity. And when Russian forces came in, they found that they were fighting a unified Ukrainian nation in which everybody, from babushkas, from grandmothers to civic institutions, they all found their way to resist. And that's a good example of our investment in Ukraine over decades. When the war hit, over 107 partners. NED is flexible, so we could immediately be by our partner's side to help them pivot, to be relevant and adapt to what they can do in a wartime environment. And now we're working with many of them to ensure that a Ukrainian victory isn't just a defeat of Russian troops on the battlefield, but it's a defeat of Putinism by Ukraine emerging as a stronger, more transparent democracy. And that's the extraordinary work of Alesia Matvichuk, who won the Nobel Peace Prize this year, by bringing together the Organization for Civil Liberties in Ukraine that's really helped lead on Ukrainians documenting war crimes. Or Ananda Bondarenko in Odessa, who started a volunteer movement to help give outlets for Ukrainians to volunteer. And when the war hit, she's now helped hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians engage, volunteer in their communities to be part of supporting the resistance. That gives you a flavor, a little bit of what we do. I can give you many more, Carol, around the world.
And we will go around the world. But Damon, since you mentioned Ukraine, I think it illustrates how far we have come and how far we need to go, because we're almost back to the future, because Russia is really acting like it did in the Soviet Union era, but with Vladimir Putin invading another country. Again, because the democratic impulse and the sense of nationalism and solidarity among the Ukrainians has been so strong, they underestimated it. Talk about this phenomenon, particularly with regard to Russia's invasion in Ukraine and how that has changed or perhaps amplified the need for NED's work.
Absolutely. I mean, Carol, in my view, there is nothing more important for the future of freedom and democracy than Ukraine's victory and repulsing this Russian invasion of their country. Protecting Ukraine's freedom will affect all narratives of freedom and democracy around the world. And so it is a front and center priority for us to support the Ukrainian people in their struggle. But you're right, it represents something that's not new. It's been quite a while since we've seen the challenge coming from Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin, but this really drove home the danger of letting autocrats go on the march. And we've seen, we're not just in a two-decade recession of democracy as documented by Freedom House. If you look at what's been really happening, particularly in the last decade, it's more of an authoritarian resurgence, really led by Beijing and Moscow, going on offense, in which they understand that increasingly their own security, their own protection for their own non-democratic regimes is about challenging democracy around the world. In Russia's case, certainly around its neighbors, to dominate them, gain spheres of influence, roll back their freedoms. But we've seen this go global, both with Russian tactics of disinformation across the world, but Chinese outreach of the export of the tools, the tactics and technologies of repression. And so what we're dealing with is a really combustible mix where the headwinds are strong against Democrats around the world, because autocrats have started to work together to coach each other, to support each other. You've seen Russian police coaching Belarusian police on how to crush the protests. And now when Russia's in trouble, you see North Korea providing ammunition, Burma providing ammunition, Iran sending drones to Moscow. You see this network of autocrats working together. Even Russia's war in Ukraine is being financed by the gold and timber that it's taken over in African countries like the Central African Republic, where it's helped ensconce an autocrat so that it, for its own interests, can use this to finance its fighting. And so the challenge today is sharper, it's greater. And that puts a real imperative on us figuring out how to be on offense and support Democrats around the world to learn from each other, to innovate, to work together in greater solidarity, and to be able to push back on this hostile environment. And so this is a new moment. It is a more challenging moment for democracy and freedom. And despite the challenge, you see the demand is extraordinarily resilient, whether in Russia itself, China itself, Iran today. And we can talk about that. But this is, despite the challenges, I see real signs for optimism.
We will talk about that right after the break. But first, you are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is President and CEO of the National Endowment for Democracy, Damon Wilson. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a new Facebook fan, Mayan Adugai from Juba, South Sudan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Back to our special guest, Damon Wilson, the president of the National Endowment for Democracy. And Damon, just before the break, we were talking about how autocracies like Iran, dictatorships like North Korea, and of course, China are working together to push back the impulse, the universal impulse for freedom and democracy that we're seeing emerge, whether in Iran, among minority groups in China, even among the Chinese, but they're so suppressed. So we can't really, you know, understand the full scope of that. And even in throughout the Soviet Union, or rather the former Soviet Union, that was a bit of a Freudian slip. So let me ask you about the limits to your extraordinary resources. What are your greatest constraints and limitations given the likes of Iran, you know, who characterize NED as some kind of an agent of espionage or destabilization? You know, the old tropes, Russia, oh, they're interfering in our affairs, you know, even though we know, you and I know, and many others know around the world, whether it's the Voice of America or NDI or IRI and their parent organization, the NED, you know, you're responding to aspirations that are emanating from these countries. It's not an imposition. So talk a bit about these constraints that you face.
Yeah, thank you, Carol, because I think it's really an important, you know, when I see this, and we see autocrats around the world wanting to demonize the endowment, it's really, in some respects, it's really sad, because what it means to me, what it shows to me, I don't think they really fear Ned. We don't have plans. We don't work in their countries. What it shows me is that they fear their own people. They fear their own civic life, their own independent media, because ultimately that's what it's about. I said at the beginning that we come to this work with a lot of humility. You can look around the United States. You know our history. We know how you've got to work at democracy, and it is not self-executing. It does not solve all your problems, but it is a means for people to shape their own future. And so part of our whole approach is to underscore that it's not our struggle, it's not our ideas, it's not our plan. We're simply here to support those who have a struggle, who have ideas, who are working to open up civic space in their country, who are working to ensure accountability of governance, who are working to provide better opportunities for individual liberty and dignity. And it's their work, when they seek support, that we're honored to help provide that moral, sometimes material support. And so the constraints we see are that many times the autocrats, they want to undermine their own people, the agency of their own people, by saying they're puppets of other actors or that they're being manipulated by outside forces. You see a real crackdown on ability to accept assistance from abroad, misuse of whether it's crackdown on COVID or counterterrorism laws to restrict civic space. And what we really see are insecure autocrats taking measures to limit freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, basic fundamental human rights of their own people. And so I think that's one of the biggest constraints, is seeing autocrats feeling that they can get away with this with impunity, and even more so in today's world, learning from each other to back each other up. And so that's what really puts pressure on so many democratic activists around the world, to help them innovate, to learn faster, to work together more effectively, be more creative and about how they deliver on the aspirations of their own constituents, their own people. And so those are, I welcome these conversations, because for the endowment, we're set up as an independent foundation that can be transparent, that can talk about what we're doing, that don't have things tied. We don't sit here in Washington and plan what's happening around the world. We have our finger on the pulse, listening to those who have the courage and the wherewithal and the ideas to really push for, you were just talking about your listener in June, amazing South Sudanese that are really pushing to get their country back on a democratic pathway and to figure out how you can have an election play out in South Sudan that can give the people a voice in selecting their leaders. And those are the people that have the courage, the ideas that we're honored to be able to support.
Now, let's turn to, for example, China. I believe you are helping the Uyghur population. Let me ask you to talk about any kind of activities you're willing to talk about, able to talk about, to support partners in China.
Sure. I think the way I think about it is Ned's built for tough times. These are places where autocratic governments are very repressive of their own populations. And so what we've done is we've responded to demand. We've been proud partners for decades of the Tibetan democracy movement. And if you follow the story of what happened to Tibet, the Dalai Lama being forced out into exile, you've seen the evolution of Tibetan exile community into a real democracy movement. And now you've got an elected government, the Central Tibetan Administration, and a legislative branch all operating out of Dharamsala. You've really seen a human rights cause evolve into a democracy cause. And that's the kind of thing that the endowment's been proud to support Tibetans through their own journey. With the Uyghurs, many around the world had never heard of the Uyghurs. And as pressure mounted on Turkic Muslim speakers and the Chinese province of Xinjiang, known as East Turkestan, groups in exile came to us for support, really to do the hard work of documenting what was happening to their brothers, their sisters, their families. And over time, through their incredible assiduous work, we're able to document incredible challenges, incredible persecutions against these communities. The advent of internment camps that over time brought in several million Uyghurs into effective training and education centers, which were really designed to help eliminate culture, language, religion, identity, in which forced sterilization became a practice, in which, whether it's Tibetan or Uyghur children, to be removed from their parents, raised in state-run boarding schools so that they could be, quote, raised as loyal Chinese and lose that sense of identity. And it's really the documentation of these groups that help bring to light in United Nations bodies and human rights discussions around the world, with governments around the world, that ultimately even led to the United States government to say that these actions amounted to genocide. We've seen Hong Kongers. One of the most incredible things that has happened is a city built on rule of law, where freedoms for civic life, political life, were rolled back extraordinarily rapidly with Beijing's passage of the national security law. And Hong Kongers so rapidly lost that freedom that they had in Hong Kong on country two systems. That's no longer the case. And to see Hong Kongers in jail today, facing trumped up charges, and many Hong Kongers that have had to flee into exile. And so we've been able to support many of those in exile that are trying to figure out what is their next step to how to think about the future of Hong Kong. I think documenting these issues, helping to tell those stories, really helping to ensure access to information. The Chinese have built the Great Firewall, as many of your listeners will understand. And so we've been proud to stand by Chinese journalists that have built an incredible independent news outlets, often digital and other means, that are finding their own ways to get information to Chinese audiences, whether in the diaspora or in the country itself. And I think it's through their ingenuity, through their ideas, through their projects, that that's what we're willing to support to really help them carve out space and figure out within the contours of an authoritarian system, what are they able to do to help advance individual liberties for their fellow citizens?
And Damon Wilson, I know you have a lot of experience or considerable interest in and experience in Africa. We know, of course, that the White House is elevating its partnership with the continent by virtue of the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit last year. Nigerian elections are coming up. You even alluded to some backsliding in democratic practice in some West African nations. Could you talk a bit about what NED is doing to help support democracy in Africa?
Well, sure. Our African partners are one of the reasons I'm sort of bullish about democracy around the world. Yes, there have been setbacks. We've seen a vicious war in Ethiopia. We've seen the rollback of a democratic transition in Sudan and coups across the Sahel, challenges in North Africa and Tunisia. But we've also seen incredible demand and resilience. You saw at the end of last year an election in Kenya that came through with contested court rulings that managed to actually change democratically elected leadership without large-scale violence that many feared. You've seen in a country like Angola, which is not exactly a completely free and open system, the greatest gains of the opposition in the last election that at least has positioned them with a force, a voice, and the parliament to demand more space and accountability. We're on the verge of Nigerian elections, which are consequential. This is the largest democratic exercise in the planet this year, one that is really below the radar for many out there, but it's hugely important. There's an energy across Nigeria where they understand this is an opportunity. The first time there isn't a foreign military commander as a leading presidential candidate, and this close to an election, we don't know who's going to win, as well as enhancements and how they actually manage the election to minimize potential for fraud, to use technology to help ensure transparency. These are exciting times, and we've got opportunities across the continent this year. There'll be an important election election in the Democratic Republic of Congo at the end of the year. There's tests in Zimbabwe, perhaps in Sudan, others in West Africa. I see an opportunity for momentum that is coming from a restless young population across Africa that is demanding more of its leaders, more accountability, expectations of governance. And it's not easy. The challenges can be great, but I'm feeling and seeing an energy across many of our African partners. I've just come back from Nigeria, and to see how a small youth group, a grassroots youth group, student group that we were able to fund many years ago, has now grown into the most important partner in helping to manage a parallel vote count across the country. And that new partners that we're funding in Nigeria are using technology, open data, to really do investigative reports that really put data front and center, government data front and center, that are really helping people respond and tackle the issue of systemic corruption, that are using STARS and Big Brothers or Afrobeats to reach large swaths of the population to get them engaged in civic life, civic political life. There's an energy that we saw in Nigeria on this recent visit from our partners that gives me some optimism about the future of democracy in Africa.
You just gave me an opportunity to plug my other program, Encounter. This week, we are doing a preview of Nigerian elections. So
fantastic.
Listeners, oh yeah, so listen up for this interesting program. Well, let me ask you a bit about a couple of other regions with which you're very familiar, Damon Wilson. For example, the broader Middle East. Iraq. We could spend a whole hour on the Levant and the many challenges, but you know, we saw Iraq, the U.S.-led invasion, and then a vibrant attempt to create a multi-party democracy. We're seeing some setbacks. Now we're going to see, hopefully, elections in Turkey, but this devastating earthquake is going to definitely have an impact on when they're going to take place. Perhaps President Erdogan may even use the earthquake to promote maybe a longer state of emergency than necessary. We shall see. And then the other country that comes to mind is Tunisia, a country in which so many of us had so much hope, and we're seeing backsliding there.
The Middle East and North Africa has gone through a lot of tumultuous time. It's been difficult ups and downs historically. The Arab Spring, the repressions that followed, devastating war in Syria. And you mentioned Iraq, and it's important, you know, in many respects, what happened in Iraq and even Afghanistan to some degree got conflated with the idea of democracy promotion. And that's where I think, if you think about what the endowment does, we're the exact opposite. We're about how to support actors on the ground, take control of their future, and build sustainable foundations of democratic culture, practices, institutions, from media, civic society, political parties, for them to figure that out. And so I'm quite proud that the endowment makes commitments to Iraqi groups today, still to Afghan groups, on what is their pathway. How do they see the ability of Iraqis to push for human rights, civic space, democratic development, and difficult circumstances? And so that approach really embeds it with what will be an Iraqi set of solutions to Iraq's democratic opportunity. It's challenging, no doubt. Iraq's been buffeted by the influence of Iranian militias across the country, challenges in its own relationship managing Turkey and the North. And yet, we see civic life active there. We see political life active. And I think what's really important is it's not for an American institution to determine that trajectory, but it is for an American institution to say, we will stand by and support your own efforts to figure this out and push this forward. And so you mentioned a couple of countries that are really important. I'm headed to Tunisia shortly, and you mentioned your disappointment in what's happening. And I think it's really important to see this in context. Has there been a rollback of some of the democratic openings in Tunisia? Absolutely. But this is a historic experiment, a society that went through, led the way in the Arab Spring, that really worked on a parliamentary democratic system, that saw a failure of its political actors to deliver on some of the economic challenges for its population, that had some headwinds from outside authoritarian actors that really didn't want to see democracy take root. And now it's hitting some bumpy ground. Just at a time when it hits bumpy ground, do we walk away? Do we turn our back? No. I think we need to understand the process, the trajectory, the effort to build a democratic culture, democratic institutions, democratic society. It takes time. And that's where the endowment's approach is one of long-term consistency to support those actors, those partners that are really working this for the long haul. And I'll be in Tunisia to demonstrate and underscore my support for the Tunisian people's experiment on how to actually have their voice heard, how to shape the future of their country, and how to have Tunisians figure it out and do it. In Turkey as well, you're right, they're headed for consequential elections this year. We are all thinking of all of our Turkish and Syrian friends that are suffering from this extraordinary earthquake. The focus has to be on an immediate humanitarian response to the people suffering in southeast Turkey, northwest Syria. But we have been standing by those Turks that are doing important work, that are providing legal defense, that are part of independent media, that are ensuring that there is going to be an opportunity for the Turkish people to vote in free elections, to help determine the course of their country. And I think those are really important tests that, again, Turks will need to determine this pathway. And we're there to support those organizations so that they can help empower the voices of their own people.
Damon Wilson is the president and CEO of the National Endowment for Democracy. Damon Wilson, thank you so much for your time and for the terrific conversation. We greatly appreciate it.
Cheryl, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.